as most of you know, we just got back from Vietnam on Friday morning, and we had asked you guys to pray for us while we were there, and in particular to pray for us that we would get back on time, of which we did. We got back kind of feet hitting the ground running. We had a wedding rehearsal on Friday afternoon, rehearsal dinner after that, and a worship night for the couple that was getting married at our home that night as well. And then the wedding was pretty much an all-day affair yesterday. So we have not had any kind of a break. But we want to tell you, firstly, thank you for your support, your love, your prayers. A really big deal. I think our trip was amazing. And your investment in us and your investment in them, I think, really paid off. We just want to share with you, you know, some highlights. And we had a chance to sit in a restaurant the last night that we were there, and highlights and lowlights. And there were definitely some lowlights on any on every mission trip that you ever go on. There are lowlights and there are highlights. It's not all highlights. The flights there, I think, were 20 hours total or something like that. And that, it's a while. It was through Seoul, Korea, and we left at 2 in the morning on some day way back then.
Wednesday
night, early Thursday morning. We got in. We were beat. We actually slept on that flight a little bit, and then got into Vietnam, and you go across the international date line, and so you lose a whole day. Like, so we left on Thursday and got in on Friday. We left on Wednesday night, really, and got in on Friday morning. Into a city, Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, those are two different names that the city goes by in what is now Vietnam. It's not South Vietnam. All of that in the white on the right is Vietnam. And Saigon is down there almost at the very bottom. And that's where we were. What was South Vietnam way back then is now a communist country with a capitalist economy. So it's very much modeled on China in that sense. And it is not a country sympathetic to the gospel or the church or anything like that. They do have a registered church. That is a church that's kind of in the public eye, that is able to buy property and build and those different kinds of things. And the underground church is the one that's really growing like a weed, and that is that's not sanctioned, and those people routinely get in trouble, although we were never in any kind of trouble. So we get there on Friday. We slept a lot. We just walked around the city. It's pretty close to, if you look at just a tiny little bit south of where is the equator. So it was probably about 85, 86, and about 150 humidity. It was like, what is that? we had a chance to get our sea legs underneath us. But here was the deal. I mean, we told you guys this before, that we did not have a chance to prepare our curriculum. We taught a group of underground church pastors, about, 50, 60 of them, on two topics, Christian marriage and biblical counseling. And we had 4 weeks to get ready, and we'd had no time, no bandwidth whatsoever to prepare a curriculum. So we were scrambling once we hit the ground to come up with our curriculum that we were going to speak about. And then on Sunday morning, had a chance to speak at one of the, when you say underground church, we're talking about really the house church. The government knows that they're there, but won't let them buy property, won't let them expand or do anything like that. And so they're sort of all stuck in a sort of a house church movement type of a thing. And so the underground church that I spoke to on Sunday morning was about, there had to be 100 people crammed in this long, narrow room. And
tiny little chairs.
Yeah, teeny tiny little chairs, not big enough for my derriere at all. And that went actually extraordinarily well there on Sunday morning. You want to share anything about that?
Yeah, I think just kind of give you a little bit of a backstory too. When we first arrived in, we really didn't have any expectations because we had no idea what we were stepping into or what we were going to, I mean, we knew the concepts that we were supposed to communicate, but it was totally a faith thing. And so the first 2 days before we even actually met the people that we were with, We had gone to Vietnam War Museum, and it's actually they changed the name just recently from War Crimes Museum.
Which is all about us.
Which is us who committed the crimes. And then they changed the name to just War Museum. But what it represented really was the whole episode of the war that had happened, and they call it their Civil War, which put a little bit of perspective on it for us. But we were the guilty people in this museum, and so as you're walking through it and you're seeing the atrocities and you're seeing the devastation and all those things, it just really impacted us of we, in their eyes, were not ones that came in to help or be helpful or rescue. We were the ones that were committing these crimes against them, and with Agent Orange and just the devastation, it was really overwhelming. And so to kind of have that background, and the reason that is because the North won, so they get to interpret how it's communicated.
The victors write the history, you know, that idea, yeah.
And so, but as we're then facing these people, I was overwhelmed with, why do you even want us here? How can you be receptive to anything that we have to say, because we've brought so much devastation to your homes, to your country? And the people that we're looking at, if they were over 40, they were a part of that. Their lives were destroyed by this war, and their families were devastated, and the people in the South really were the ones that took the brunt of everything, because when the North then won and came down, they took their homes, they took their families, they brutally killed people, and anybody that was in any political position either was killed or had to flee the country, and so they were the ones that came over as refugees. So there's just, you're seeing these people looking in their faces, and again, if they're anything around our age or older, you can't even imagine what they have lived through and endured. So that was kind of the backdrop then of going into these people, into their home, and seeing all these elderly people. And for me, it was hard to separate the understanding of their graciousness, because they were such a kind and gentle and loving people. And I don't think they were faking it. They're not like Americans where we can just, you know, put on a face and present one thing but feel something totally different. It wasn't like that. And so it was really humbling to sit in front of them and to interact with them, just with even that little backdrop. And then the other backdrop that's important to know is, again, we know that culture is different, and we know that ways people live are different, but theirs is so different from our way of life in so many things. The only danger that we were really in at any point was every time we crossed the street.
Unbelievable.
They're literally, and we don't have pictures to show of it, but there are literally hundreds and thousands of motorbikes, mopeds, scooters that people were riding all the time. And it was between the scooters and the taxis and the buses that was what made up the streets. And we walked everywhere for the most part, except when we went long distances. And so every time you were out, you kind of had to take a big breath, because it's you knew you were going to have to cross streets. And there is no, there's no traffic lights per se, and there really aren't any rules and laws
This is a city of 9 to 11 million people, so there's a lot of people here.
So anytime
they all ride motorcycles at the same time.
Yeah, so anytime you had to cross the street, it was literally, there was no break in the traffic, so you couldn't kind of wait until it slowed down. You just had to, start walking. And literally you're walking into full-blown traffic the whole
time. Not kidding.
And so we were told ahead of time that the only way to do this is you just walk slowly at the same pace. Because if you speed up, they're anticipating your speed. But if you speed up, you throw them off, and they're going to, you know, run into you or whatever. So literally you're stepping off, and I would grab onto his arm, and he would kind of lead the way.
It's like, what are you doing? Like a monster grip.
Because you're seriously walking across the street. I'm going, oh God, oh God, oh God. You know, because you're seeing this bus coming right for you, and you're just like, oh, it was safer to close your eyes and walk than it was to actually open. So that was kind of a perpetual state of, okay, I can do this, I can do this. And we would get to the other side, and we're like, yeah, you know, we made it. You'd come up to this literally, I'm sorry, this is just more than you really need to know, but you come up to this rotary, which was a main rotary if we went anywhere outside
around
of just
about a big, a
our
giant
immediate area.
Roundabout.
So maybe 12 main roads coming into this big rotary section. And you have, you know, people coming, thousands of mopeds and buses and everything, all coming into the same rotary. And it, normally you think they all go the same direction, but they don't. Some decide to go this way, and some come in, you know, from this angle, and they're going this way, and then they turn this way. And so it's just complete mayhem. But you have to walk across this as well. And so that was crazy. So we figured out a couple days into it that you just find an older woman who's carrying a lot of things, and you just stand right behind her, and you walk, because she's got it figured out, and she doesn't care. She just, you know, walks straight forward, and nobody hits her, so we would stay close to
this is,
these people.
This is Becky's interpretation of this. After about the second time across the street, I figured it out. She just never really acclimated to that. And for me, it was like it was like swimming in a sea of fish. I mean, in a school of fish, where the fish just go right around you. That's the way that it works, and you just have to go slow so that they know where you're going. And they all adjust. No one gets mad. There's nobody that flipped us off, or this isn't like California or anything like that. You know, there it would be open season if it was here. You know, people would be. And I felt for Vietnamese people that come to America, because they're like, they just walk out in the intersection, just get absolutely plowed down, you know. Because, like, no, we do not have those same kind of rules there.
But I do have to say, he's the only one that got hit out of the two of us.
I did get hit. I didn't look right. And I didn't realize that it was a one-way street going this way, and I didn't look right. Because there was no need to, but there were still people coming from that direction against the traffic flow. And
anyway,
I walked out, and bam, this woman hit me in her moped or in her scooter. It was like, what?
So,
the heck?
Anyway, so that was kind of the backdrop. So now
yeah,
bring
that's
it
more
into
than you need to know. Sorry about that, but that was a walk of faith, though. That was the walk of faith in the whole thing.
We wanted you to have some of the experience with us.
Yeah.
So then Sunday morning, going into the home church. Again, it was just a really sweet time. The interpreter did a really great job. Bob spoke on that morning. And afterwards, the pastor had some of the children come up from downstairs and prayed over them. And it was really a really kind of gentle, tender introduction into their culture and into them. And that was really sweet.
And Pastor Song, he's the main guy. He's, as I understand it, he's the one that kind of leads the whole house church movement, and there are 6,000 house churches or something like that in Vietnam. And when we say house churches, it's just because they can't get licenses to meet in other buildings and things like that. And so they basically will gut a house, a floor in a house, and make it into an official little sanctuary that's about 7 to 10 feet wide and about 40 feet long. So that was what it was, and it was an official church service, and it was amazing. I mean, people worship with their whole hearts. They're charismatic, so spent a lot of time kind of speaking in tongues and singing in tongues, and then taking off into a worship song. It was really, really beautiful. And then we got home from, you know, went back to our hotel from that, and we're like, okay, we have to actually figure out what we're going to talk about tomorrow on Monday. So we did classes with them at a training center that was about 30 minutes away from our hotel for Monday through Thursday. And we were 8:30 to 4, basically, with about, you know, with little breaks and then a little siesta nap. We didn't really understand, like, in the middle of after lunch at 12:45, everybody takes a nap.
You have to picture this then. So we have lunch, and they bring us, they have it all family style, where some of the women come in early and they cook these really elaborate, beautiful meals and put all the food out, and everyone's eating family style. And so they had taken us into a side room, and we met with a couple of the leaders each meal, different leaders, and talked with them. So the first day we come out after lunch, and we have 45 minutes before the next session starts, and we walk out, and everybody's sound asleep.
Everywhere.
Like on the floor, everywhere. Under the tables, just laying there sound asleep. And they said, you know, we'll take you up to your room. We're like, okay. You know, and so we walk up, you know, four flights of stairs in this little side thing, and there's this little room, and there's the, you know, the little foam mats that you put in a kid's room that they fit together like, a little puzzle kind of thing. Well, there's that laid on the floor, and then there's a couple little blankets folded up in pillows, and that's where the people that were coming from the tribal areas, which are at a distance, the villages, come for a week at a time, 1 week a month for 3 years to get trained. And they stay there, and that's what they sleep on, and that's all that they have is their little pillow, their blanket, and their little backpack. So anyway, we went up into one of those rooms, and they said, okay, you have 40 minutes, and then you can come back down for the next session. So we're like, okay, this is unusual. This is great. And so we just lay down, and we're both like,
I'm jacked up on Vietnamese coffee.
We don't get this concept, and now you go to sleep, and then you wake up. And so, but it was good because it was a time for us to just kind of lower our RPMs and just pray a little bit and relax and then go back into the afternoon session.
So we've got 50 or 60 men and women in front of us in a long, narrow room and for each one of those 4 days. And they, 80% of them are from the sticks. They're from rural areas, and it's much more dangerous to be a Christian in a rural area than it is to be in the city. I mean, honestly, the Communist Party just can't keep track of 11 million people that well. So it's much safer in the city. But the ones, the lion's share of them are from out in the farms and different kind of places all over the southern part of Vietnam. And just beautiful people. They love to learn. So, you know, we're talking about people that mostly were farmers before or, you know, were herds people of some, and still are. In many cases, and so the school was the brainchild, the vision of Pastor Song, of having, because these people have been pastoring these churches with pretty much no training, but they were the only ones that were available to do it, and so they wanted to create a school for them to be able to provide official training for them, and at the end of that, have a graduation, which was, we'll show you some pictures of that in just a moment, but we were the last class in 3 years of training for these people. And we were the only, that they called level five classes. They had level ones all the way through level five classes. And they would come, they would make their way in 1 week a month for 3 years to be trained. And they're tenaciously committed people. The guys absolutely give you no listening feedback whatsoever. So they're just like, that's really good for me, as you know. And the women on the our, you know, as we're looking out our left hand side, they're much more engaged in terms of you know, listening actively and different kind of things like that. Everybody took notes. Like, I'm fairly certain that they took notes verbatim. Everything that we said, they wrote down. And and so, it, interestingly enough, super somber-looking guys especially, and then when I would do something funny, it would be the most uproarious laughter. I mean, like, accelerating from 0 to 150 miles an hour in humor all, you know, at one time. And so it was, they are a hearty people. I mean, they laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh. But we had a chance in the mornings, we gave them some curriculum to translate. We were planning on starting the morning with biblical marriage and then go get the counseling in the afternoon, as it turned out that they only had the biblical counseling stuff translated. And so that's what we started with. And we weren't really ready to start with that. And so I got done teaching the first session of 3 in the morning. And I gave all the material that we had in that first session. And it was like, oh, no, what are we going to do from here, you know? And so
a low light of the trip was we kind of knew that we would encounter some barriers and warfare, but we didn't know what to expect, and it did not come in the way at all that we expected. And so the first session, as he's speaking, I think because they shifted things, and again, we're walking into something completely blind and not having any feedback or cultural standards to go by, we were just so neutral in it. And then when he started to speak in the first session, it was like this wave of confusion hit and this doubt, and it was this overwhelming sense of, oh no, we have 4 days to speak to these people and we don't have anything to say. What are we going to do? And it was this really bizarre feeling that kind of fell on both of us. And I'm sitting next to him and he's standing up talking, and I can see his eye twitching in the side, and I can see on the outside he's presenting just fine, but I knew what was going on inside of him. And
I'm going down.
And I can see it, you know, in his skin that's starting to shake, and I'm thinking, oh no. And then all of a sudden it was like, start praying, just start praying. And so I just started praying, and I was breaking, you know, confusion over us, and I was asking for the Lord's clarity and praying for the session to end.
And we got to the end of that session. It was like, everybody, just please leave. Please leave.
We're done. Go home.
Yeah, we're completely worthless.
So that was a really startling feeling. And immediately I knew, okay, this is warfare. And so after we said, okay, you have a 15-minute break, and sent everybody out of the room, and I just grabbed him and I said, sit down, we need to pray. And I said, we're in warfare right now. We need to really pray and get this off of us and get clarity. And so we did, we prayed. And then from then on out, it was just everything changed in terms of our connection with them and the dynamic and the Lord's presence and confidence and stuff. So that was the real low point, because at the end of that day, I think we were both still shell-shocked from that experience, even though the rest of the day went really well. But as we're driving back and we walk into our hotel room after the first day, we just looked at each other like, can we go home, please?
Can we go home? I don't want to do this
because
anymore.
Can we just
click our heels and say, no place like home, and we'll just go back home?
And I told Bob, it reminded me of when I gave birth to our fourth child, and right before I went into labor, we're sitting in the parking lot at the hospital, and I'm having my labor pains, and knowing the only way to get through this is to deliver the baby, and then I'll be through it. And that's the same feeling that I have, is like, there's no way out. We just have to do this and get through it. And so it was just this, oh, God, okay, you're going to have to come through, because we just don't have anything to give. But the Lord was faithful.
And so we had all of these things that were between the 4 weeks of we got invited and getting ready, we had no chance. I mean, she would get home at 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. I get home at 9 at night. And we'd say, we need to prepare some stuff to speak to the Vietnamese pastors. And, okay, you know, and then we would, you know, we wake up the next morning like, oh, you know, we got to do this. And we just didn't have a chance. There was just no bandwidth to do it. So we get through the week, the people are really receptive. It was, it just took us a little while to kind of figure them out. And I think figure us out as well.
So I just have to say, at the end of that first day, when we went back into the other section, the marriage.
I can't remember.
Anyway,
it's all a blur.
I kind of got up and summarized a little bit of what we had talked about in that session, and we had made a list of things that were important to them to talk about, and they were things like
persecution,
homosexuality among their teenagers, you know, just really intense issues that they were facing. And so then I got up, and as soon as I started to talk, I just started to cry. And it was just these tears that came down, and it was really the Lord's heart, but I was just communicating. I don't even remember the essence of what I communicated.
It was riveting. It was, I think, the high point, honestly.
But at that point where I felt really disconnected, all of a sudden, all of their eyes were just, you know, riveted on me, and they're just seeing these tears come down, and then you see these little tears, you know, start coming down some of the men's faces and the women's faces. you know, completely changed. But it was, I think that that was kind of a turning point for us into their lives and them letting us in to speak into them, because there was just a real tenderness that was there of the Lord's heart for them. And it was really a sweet, sweet moment.
So we would get done at 4, get taxied back to our hotel. We would go out and eat some pho. I can't eat any more pho. P-H-O is how that's pronounced, pho.
And if you don't know what pho is, it's basically a broth with noodles and fresh vegetables in it and sometimes some meat and stuff. It's
good.
It's pho.
It's just not
good
for every meal every day. So for me personally, I'd like a little variety. So we would come and we would go get something to eat out in the city, and then we would come back and spend, you know, the rest of the night preparing for the next day. So it was work the whole time. And it was really worth it work, but it was work the whole time. So we would have loved to have, I mean, you know me, I like being prepared. We were not. So we had to deal with that and work as best as the way we could. And we ended up doing a lot of things on the fly that really actually worked. At one point in time, we talked to them about the five languages of love, which were, there's five of them, right? Yeah, okay. Yeah. The 28 languages of love. Well, because you had to add food to that. That's not even anywhere on the list, you know. And so we, she talked about this, you know, and she had this 1 hour session, and she got done with her teaching material in about 5 minutes. And
that's not true.
And it was like, okay, 8 minutes.
No, that's
or
not
something.
True.
but it was like, Beck, we have a lot of time to fill here. You know, what are we going to do? You know, and so I just, she started asking them. So
actually, that was a really meaningful time, because yeah, we weren't sure how they would connect to, because this is, for us, this is kind of a Western concept. And to be able to talk about how we show love. But again, as soon as I started to talk about it, they were, you know, they're just ferociously writing down these things, and then we would interact a little bit. And so this was day 3 now that we had talked about this topic. And so they knew us a little bit. We had had interactions with them. There was some rapport that was starting to build. And so after I had gone through the different five languages of love, which are, if you don't know, basically they're physical touch, not sexual, but just being able to hold someone's hand or touch them or whatever, that if someone does that to you, that means really that they're communicating love to you. Quality time, spending quality time, words of affirmation, saying things that are meaningful. Gift giving or gift receiving. And the last one, I'm completely
acts of service.
Acts of service. Just doing something kind for the person. So anyway, and we put some flesh on that, what that looked like in their culture and so forth. But we used ourselves as examples in a lot and kind of role played out things, which they just thought was hysterical because just of how we communicate and how physical, you know, he's always touching. And I have to say a side note, our interpreter was probably about this tall, and she looked like she was 12 years old. She was 26 years old. Her name was Candy. And
that's not a real name. A real name is something like something like that, you know.
Yeah. So anyway,
it was like, what? Say that again? It's like, I don't. What?
So Candy, we had talked with her right up front and just said, if we do anything that offends you, please forgive us. We don't mean to. So right off the bat, you know, as Bob's touching her and using her as examples and as illustrations,
she's not liking it.
And so anyway, she, as we go through this whole love language situation, then I said, okay, so let's see what this looks like in practical terms. And so I said, you guys have seen Bob now for a couple of days. What would you guess is his love language? And you have to know that after every session, he would get up and he would go out, you know, and he would just hug on the guys and shake their hands, and he'd go over to the women and he'd, you know, grab their hand and, you know, nod to them and bow. And so this was after every session. So this is, by this point, this was already at least a minimum of 9 sessions that this little sequence had happened. And so they all looked at me, and one guy goes, quality time, and then this whole sea of voices is touch, touch.
Like, and they yeah. just laugh. And so after that, and one of the guys that I'll show you a picture of in just a minute, after that, all the guys thought this was great. So they're like, they're going to fondle me for the rest of that, you know. They're like, oh, Pastor Bob, you know, and they go all over my butt and everything. I was like, stop that, you know.
Because they really wanted to say we love you. And so
yeah,
just like,
it's like big mistake.
It's like, you got it. You guys got it. You get it. You totally get how this works. So anyway, that was really, really fun. So the funny thing, too, on top of that, then we had this little break. And so I was sitting there with Candy, the interpreter, while everyone's out of the room. And I said, so Candy, what do you think your love language is? And she said, oh, that's really hard. I've been thinking about it. And she said, I think my love language is touch. And I just kind of looked at her and I thought, it is? Because she was so, you know, every time Bob would touch her.
And I touched her a lot.
But as the week went on, she just so softened, and she'd kind of be like, as he's interpreting something, she knows he's about to touch her. And so she would kind of prepare herself. And then at one point, it shifted where she would start to say, he would interpret something, and so she would interpret it back, and she's like, can I push you back? And so he'd be like, yeah, and she'd be like.
Yeah.
It was really hysterical, but anyway.
So here is the deal. So we get told on Wednesday morning that on Thursday that we need to wrap up our sessions teaching at 11 because they're going to have a graduation. And there were two different issues with that. We both looked at each other like, we're done at 11. We don't have to prepare any more teaching stuff. It's like, gosh, we were just working our tails off. And what we didn't realize is that, I mean, think about it. These people have been laboring in rural areas, completely disconnected from anything and everyone. And a lot of them have been in jail over a year. Lots of them. So this is not one or two of them. Most of them have experienced some extended time in jail for their faith.
At least once.
Yeah, at least once.
Yeah.
A lot of them way more than once. And so they're people that maybe didn't have a high school education or anything like that, and they have been trained as pastors for 1 week, a month, for 3 years. And that did a number of things. One, it connected them with a group of people that they weren't connected with before, so they're no longer in isolation. They have slept side by side with these people in the training center on the floor, you know, for 1 week, a month, for 3 years. And they're connected to each other now, which is extraordinary and beautiful. And then I realized, because I thought, okay, they're going to have a graduation. And then the leaders come and hand them all cap and gowns. And if you'll go to the next slide there. That's Candy.
Candy.
That's Candy.
That's our interpreter.
And the size and the perspective is about right there. And then the next one, please. That's the guy who had his hands all over my rear end and everything. He just thought that was the funniest thing ever. And I'm like, that is not saying I love you to me. But he didn't speak English, so he didn't get it. I just had to go, okay, thank you. I know that you're expressing love to me. But they gave them these cap and gowns, and you wouldn't believe the transformation on their faces as each one of them put on their cap and gown. Hard to even express the legitimacy and the respect, the sense of self-respect and confidence. And it said, you know, one of them had said something like, you know, maybe people will respect us now. You know, kind of a thing. And I sat in the back as the stuff, go to the next slide if you would. This woman got up and spoke.
I want to tell her story. So on day two, we had done a session on forgiveness and walked them through the steps of forgiveness and how to pray with people. It was during the counseling session. And it was a really powerful session. And when this woman spoke, they had three students that they had chosen to speak at the graduation. And she spoke. She was the first one. And she said, I have to say that when you started to speak, when Pastor Bob and Becky started to speak, I didn't want to hear what they had to say. And you could just see kind of the pain in her face. And she said, then when you spoke on forgiveness, I realized that I had to forgive, that I had to do this, because he had used the analogy of every time that you have a hurt and someone harms you or does something against you, you put a bar and then you put another bar, and then before you know it, you've created this prison around yourself. And as long as you choose not to forgive, you remain in that prison. And so forgiveness is removing those bars. And so she talked about how she one by one started to forgive and take those bars off. And she just talked about how it was life-changing perspective for her, because she had been holding on to so much for so many years. And then she said, and then I realized, you know, that what you had to give us was so freeing. And she just spoke about that, and it was so powerful. Because again, you're seeing a woman who, and I remember looking into her face as we were talking about those things, and just kind of this stone face, and then through the sessions, you would just start to see this smile and the light kind of come in her, and this warmth that was there that was really, really beautiful.
So we had the graduation, and it was super meaningful. Go to the next slide, if you would, please. So this is the three, four, four or five, you know, senior leaders of the movement, and they were praying over the students as they stood there. Candy was in the back, just, you know, interpreting for us the whole time what everything was going on. And it was you all, so that you know, this your investment in us to go was really an investment in them, and a really, really a big deal. It was not a you know, and that looks, you know, it doesn't look like very many graduates or anything like that, but those people are in the bushes leading people to Christ, getting jailed for it, making disciples. Their families are getting abused, and they're getting abused for the sake of the gospel. We asked a number of times, you know, do you try to flee persecution? Their response is uniform. We believe persecution is good for us, and it's good for the church. So we don't flee from that at all, because it makes the church a very pure article. And that is just not the way that we think, is it? It's not a way that Americans think at all.
And the cost is so high for them, because when we're talking about things about forgiveness, we know that we're touching into deep roots for them. Mm-hmm. But the grids that they're going through, or when we're talking about marriage and being able to be of one mind and one heart, they're dealing with issues like, my wife who started out as a believer, and I went to prison for a year and then come out, and we've had to farm the land. She's had to farm the land alone while I'm in prison, and then I get released, and that didn't work, so they leave us alone for a time, but then they come back and they put my father in prison for a year. And then the children start growing up and they go for education, and knowing that they're in the church, the government won't sign off on the papers that they need for their kids for education, or for if they need to borrow money for land or something, the government won't sign off on it because they're associated with the church. And so after a while, the wives start to get resentful that now my children can't go to school and we're doing all this for Jesus. And so it brings a lot of tension in their relationships and marriages. So these are the depths of the issues. Mm-hmm. It's not like, oh, I just don't like the way you iron my shirt. It's, no, you're costing our family greatly. And so when we talk about things of forgiveness or of marriage and being working together, and that you can see the depth that this hits inside of them and how meaningful it is. But I think for them, again, to see us standing up there together and communicating stories, mm-hmm. it gave them hope, and it gave them a vision of what it can be like to work together and to do this together, not alone. And again, they told us how powerful that was to see right in front of them two people that can actually live for Jesus and sacrifice, even though our sacrifice is so minimal compared to what their sacrifice is. It was something that they could hold on to and say, we can do this. You know, we want this. We want to work together. We want our marriages to thrive. We want to forgive. We want to to communicate love. We need each other. So yeah. It was really powerful.
Yeah. So thank you. Thank you for praying for us, for lifting us up, for being generous and giving and sending us. Huge, huge thing for them. They want us to come back and do this same stuff for a much larger group of pastors at some point in time. I don't know why they do, but they do.
But it was clearly, again, we can't tell you how meaningful it was for everyone praying for us, for your, you know, financially being able to get us there, the investment that it made in their lives and how important it was for them and how significant the concepts were for them. There's just no, you can't put words on it, right? The value that they kept communicating to us and how much it meant to them for us to come and to teach them, because education and training is so important to them. Mm-hmm. And even though we didn't feel like we really had significance to communicate for them, it was huge. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I want to talk to you for 5 minutes. I'm serious, actually. I'm going to give you the very high view on this, but I think that it's something that the Lord wants us to hear. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 7, the Apostle Paul is speaking about enduring in the midst of hardship, and he's talking about that when this earthly tent is destroyed, that we have, and that is when we die, that something much better awaits us. And at that point in time, and after that, so we can live in the light of eternity. And because of that, he says, we live or walk by faith and not by sight. That's verse 7. We walk by faith, not by sight. Would you say that with me? We walk by faith, not by sight. And faith is this dynamic, active reliance on God and his leadership in our lives. And through it, we move daily in an active partnership with God in his kingdom advancing. So I want to make three comments about not this, not this, not this, and then two that is this and this. That firstly, and this pertains to us, and this is us as a witness on this, in that I think that one of the things that this kind of faith is not is this sort of static, comfortable faith where we come to church, we open our Bibles every once in a while, we read, but we really never take any risks. We never really put our lives into play for the purposes of God. We're comfortable. And so we have this faith, we give, we tithe, we do this kind of the standard Christian things, but we never are out of our comfort zone at all. We're never really taking any risks. We don't really, for the most part, open up our wallets to people and are really generous with them and different kinds of things like that. We're just in sort of this, I would call it the comfortable American faith zone. And it's not that. Another kind of dimension of not this would be that we're kind of anxious and thinking, you know, God, I'm going to miss it. I just don't want to miss it. Oh, I don't want to miss it. And instead of actually participating with God, we just are anxious all the time thinking that we're going to miss it. And we can do this pretty easily. I remember years ago we were doing a worship night back in Boston, and one of the older gals that was a part of our church, she started to sing during this time a song, just a very mournful song, Lord, Don't Leave Me Behind. And she was singing that to the Lord because she just felt like, I'm not being included in your purposes. I'm not stepping out in that. And I think that we can get comfortable and anxious. We get either comfortable or we can get anxious. I'm not finding it. And another not this is that I'm looking in particular at our resources, which for us, you didn't hold back. For most part, you guys just gave unbelievably generously on this. But I think for the most part, what we do is we hold on to our resources and we think, well, I got to be responsible with everything that God has, you know, really entrusted to me. And so we don't put that into play very much with our resources. That is to say that what we don't do is mix the resources that we have with our faith in generosity to others. And when we do that, it makes our lives very, very, very different. So it's not that, it's not comfortable faith, it's not anxious faith, it's not tight fisted or tightwad faith. And so what it is for one, to be generous with our resources in faith that God is including us in his work. The illustration that comes to my mind on this would be in the early church in Acts chapter 4. It says that all the believers were of one heart and mind. And they no one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything they had. And there, that so that there was not a needy person among them. For from time to time, those who owned land or houses sold them, brought the money from the sales and put it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to anyone as we had need. About a year ago, I believe that the Lord started to push us out of our comfort zone and say, I want you to start giving. In the last probably 6-7 months, we've actually been doing that more and more and more. And so I do weddings out. I've told you, you know, I do weddings out in the wine countries and different things like that. So I get some money from that. And normally, you know, that's been like guitar money and different kind of things like that to spend on myself. And I've just been thinking, okay, so I'm just going to, Lord, I'm going to take this $300. I'm just going to sow it into the lives of somebody else. We went to a banquet for a friend of mine who has a ministry, an orphanage in Zambia, and I had $300 in my pocket, and I was just looking for a place to give it, not so I could get anything back. And we've just been doing that, and as we've been doing that, God has just made over and over and over again all kinds of things available to us that were never available to us before, because we're starting to see our resources as kingdom capital of something that we can sow out there, and that God will make sure that we're blessed and taken care of, but we're participating in the kingdom by investing our resources with faith into anything and everything that we can see God doing. And so that's the first thing I believe that God wants us to hear today, is he wants us to take our resources and invest it. I was in India years ago, and as I was there the first trip, I was sitting in the headquarters of the missions organization that I was working with there, and I was looking at this TV on the wall with all these VHS tapes and training things, and it was a whole bunch of Word of Faith, Jerry Seville and Kenneth Copeland and Kenneth Hagin, and these are doctrinally people that I think are suspect, because it's the prosperity gospel, the American prosperity gospel kind of thing of you know, give big so that you can, you know, drive Bentleys and Mercedes-Benzes and have large cars and large houses and all these different kind of things. And I've had a very difficult time with that. So I'm looking at this wall and thinking, oh no, I'm out of my depth here. I didn't know that these people were kind of going in that direction with this. But what I found was that they were using some of those principles of, I'm going to take whatever God gives me, I'm going to give it generously. And by giving generously, I'm saying to the Lord, I am believing you for a bicycle so that I can go to the next village and lay down my life and plant a church. And then I'm going to give everything I've got there so that I'm believing you, I'm giving away so that I can get a motorbike so that I can go to 3 villages and lay down my life and plant churches and give my life for the gospel. It's like, that is the real deal. That is looking at those principles and utilizing and sowing in with faith in a way that really has the kingdom values as well as the kingdom principles. So that's the first thing. Be generous with our resources. The second thing is, in terms of what this is tell the Lord, show me a door and I will walk through it. Would you say that with me? Show me a door and I will walk through it. Look for opportunity. Show me a door and I will walk through it, whatever that is. Lord, I'm looking for opportunities, and I will jump in. I will jump in wherever that you say. And the verses to back that up are they're everywhere, frankly. You look at Abraham from Genesis chapter 12 on. This is Abraham, the father of faith's way of living in this. Then you look at the book of Acts, and it's just one thing after another. In the book of Acts in chapter 5, you know, they arrested the apostles and put them in the public jail. And during the night, an angel of the Lord opened up the doors of the jail and brought them out. Go, stand in the temple courts, he said, and tell the people all the people about this new life. And Peter and the other apostles, basically they go out, they do that. The Pharisees grab them, they spank them on the hand. They said, you can't talk in the name of Jesus. And Peter, that's where Peter says that famous thing. It's what are we going to do? Obey God or obey you? No, we're going to obey God in this whole thing. And the early church was built on that kind of a dynamic. And you see this in these Vietnamese pastors, men and women, right and left. They just see opportunity and they go for it. They see it and they go for it. It's like, am I going to be put in jail? Maybe. I see the opportunity and I go for it. And I, folks, I believe that that's what God is calling us to. that God is not calling us to go to jail. That's not what I mean. But God has called us to start taking those faith risks. Does that make sense? And that was a 10-minute message, not a 5. Sorry. Sorry, I doubled my, but we doubled our money. So here's what I'm saying in summary. Give generously anywhere you sense the Lord prompting you. Anywhere. If God puts a need in front of you, meet it as best you can. You're investing in the kingdom of God when you do. And when you see anything that God might be doing, jump in with both feet. Join him in whatever you see him doing, and you will see the kingdom come. You will see the kingdom come. I mean, being with people in a different country who are doing this every day, all day long, is honestly, it's amazing. But honestly, this is not something that's reserved for Vietnamese people and people who are being pounded for the gospel. This is all of our inheritance. Amen? Amen. Amen. Let's stand.